I'm always buying and selling stuff, and it depends on your budget too, what you want to spend. I mean, I want to keep it to a minimum as a cost. My first radio, I still remember, 58 years ago, I paid $25 for a Heathkit Tour and a 5-element jack for someone. So, you know, you'd be surprised what you can do on the secondhand market, and but don't shortchange yourself by underpowering, meaning the components you expect to get an amplifier, and the components you're going to buy can't handle the power, well, get the one that can. Back to you.
C2GS. Well, that's good advice, Joe. People should kind of, like I said, have a long chat with themselves and try and figure out as best they can. This is very problematic at the beginning of this hobby because none of us really based it on a lot of knowledge that we had. When I first bought an antenna tuner, I ended up with the one that was compatible with my first base station, which was the ICOM 7100. I got a third-party antenna tuner that worked directly with the electronics of the 7100. And it was only rated for 100 watts because that's what it was designed for, the ICOM 7100. It was only later on that I decided to upgrade to the 6700, which was also 100 watts. But then I heard about solid-state amplifiers, linear amplifiers. Up until that point, I kind of didn't think I was going to be able to get away with it because I really wasn't prepared to do the extra work that I had heard other people complain about of getting dedicated 220-volt lines into their shack and the plastering and all the other nonsense. So at that time, it made perfect sense to have a 100-watt antenna tuner. Then I realized that the efficiencies of solid-state amplifiers allow me to use a 120-volt connection and in a non-dedicated line without affecting any of my electricity in my house. And I'm very, very happy with my Expert Systems 1.3K linear amplifier, but I didn't have the faintest clue that it existed when I bought the 100-watt antenna tuner. So, you know, sometimes you can plan things, sometimes you can't plan things. That's the nature of life. Getting back to you, Wes, you know, it sort of depends. My 6700 has a built-in antenna tuner that I have almost never used. Again, very much like Japanese antenna tuners, it does not have a great range. I have always used, I have manual, I have auto antenna tuners. Right now I have two PALSTARs, I have a HF auto, and a AT2KD manually operated full legal power antenna tuners that I use for my two antenna systems. It depends what you want, is that determines the price. And if you're lucky, you get something used, because a lot of these things are built like tanks, so they survive longer than almost any other piece of ham gear. A lot of them are pretty much just a big variable capacitor and a big variable inductor.
T-Mash.
Right.
You're breaking in.
The question that I have is, what is it that you don't like about the radio, if there's anything, and what is the maximum power? 600 amps.
The maximum HF power for all of the 6000 series, to my understanding, is 100 watts. If the question is, what do I not like about my 6700, there are little foibles it has. In order to operate on 2 meters, it has to do some little electrical engineering tricks. It switches in and out anti-aliasing filters that are important for digital radio technology, for software-defined radios, and that sometimes causes a glitch and the inputs will shift out of position and I have to reselect the inputs. The big thing that I have a problem with Flex is not with the hardware or the design or the technology behind it. It's unfortunately the big thing that I really love about software-defined radio is you can change the firmware and effectively get yourself a new radio. A lot of features are purely software-based. So if you put the time and effort in programming the software of a software-defined radio, you can add features to it. When the 6000 series first came out, it had no repeater capabilities. You couldn't configure it with a split or anything. It didn't have a PL tone. That was all implemented in software. When 2.0 firmware came out, all of a sudden, all the flexes were capable of operating repeater type of transmissions. And so all you need is a good imagination and a decent programmer, and you can put all kinds of great features. Now, Flex, unfortunately, has gone the low-cost route, and they have been very sluggish. The last year and a half has kind of struck everyone. But when it comes to programming, I think most programming takes place at home. So theoretically, if they hired guys and paid them, they'd work at home, and they'd do the work at home, and we'd have a new, better software. But they didn't. So that's my one black mark against them.
Thank you very much. And to exchange.
KD2FIU?
Yes, George.
Yeah, going back on the, can we go back on the antenna tuners for just a tiny bit here so I can help anybody out there who is listening?
Sure you can, George. That's the whole point of this TechNet.
I found, with my experience, is the older type T-Match networks. Those are the manual antenna tuners that are two capacitors in series with an inductor grounded that is isolated, and that inductor is actually isolated from your transmission network. So you tune the inductor and you tune the capacitor to the radio and then tune the capacitor to the antenna. That to me seems to be the widest. You got the L network, which is in the radios, inside the radios, and they'll bring you the 3-to-1. 3-to-1, 4-to-1, 5-to-1. You're switching the capacitor on either the feed line or the antenna line of the network. That's 3-to-1, and at best, if you can put a bunch of those parallel, you're getting 10-to-1. But the original MAT one that I mentioned, the T-MASH, can bring you anywhere to about maybe 40-to-1. And that's the difference. That's the way why I like manual inductors. KD2FIU.
A question that I have. Did you call T instead of P? Enter again.
No, I prefer a manual T match, Tango, versus a switched Lima. The switched Lima could be within 3 to 10 to 1, but a good T match can actually bring out 60-to-1 with a more favorable match.
But T is actually P. Capacitor is granted, it's a P network. P. Enter G.
No, two capacitors across an inductor is a pi. Not a P, a pi.
That's correct. I use the British way of P. Pi. I agree with that. I just didn't know that when you were saying T network, you were talking about the Pi network. Thank you.
Roy, why don't you just make one more comment about this, please?
Sure, George.
This is why I've always favored manual tuners. Most manual tuners from early days through even later days were made as a T-match. A capacitor is facing the transmission of the radio, and a capacitor is facing the line, or your antenna. Your inductor is going to an insulated ground. That insulated ground is away from the radio. It is insulated from the radio. That inductor is facing only the capacitors. And with that, I have found that engineers over the years have made 1,000 watt antenna tuners, manual antenna tuners. They've made 500 watt, 300 watt, 2,000 watt antenna tuners. And there are different ratings if you look some of them up as to they have limitations. But you could take a 2,000 watt manufactured T-match antenna tuner and put 100 watts into it. It will match anything. But at 2,000 watts, it's going to give you a limitation. So that's the thing about T-match tuners that I can appreciate. If you were to get your hands on a very, very, very high power T-match tuner and run it at low power, you're going to tune your radio to the radiator pipe in your house if you know how to do it. And it's easy to do, and you can do it in 3 seconds, KD2FIU.
Okay, that's very interesting, George. Now, you got to keep in mind that, you know, everything isn't quite black and white. There's all kinds of shades of gray. Just as an example, I have a Palstar HF Auto. It's an auto-tune, full legal power. It's configured in a T-match, so it's not an L-match. The L-matches are very popular, especially with auto-tuners that tune by switching in and out inductances and capacitances. So they're just a bunch of little inductors and capacitors and relays. The Palstar is run by servo, so if you open up the box, it looks very much like a manual tuner. It has a big silver-plated variable inductor and capacitor, and servos connected to all of them, and they do their thing, and they make their match. And it matches very well. As I mentioned before, I can match a doorknob. When my fan dipole snapped apart, and all I pretty much had was a coax cable, I was able to get a 50-ohm impedance for my for whatever was stuck at the end of my coax cable, despite the fact that it probably didn't radiate anything or anywhere. So they're still around. My other manual is a differential T-match from the same company, from Palstar. That's very nice, and it has a differential mode for the two capacitors, so it tunes both of them simultaneously with one knob. So they're still around. They still have great tuning potential. L-based impedance networks are cheaper, quicker, dirtier, easier, and more limited, as you mentioned. You can throw more inductance and more capacitance on it and let it work a little bit better, but all things being equal, Pi networks are very effective, and T networks are very effective for matching transmission impedances.
KD2FIU, yeah, the Pi network has the most range, and it also has its limitations. But what I'm getting at is, for those who are just coming in to HF, try the T-match, a manual T-match. It's going to work. And don't worry about hitting a button. Get in there, learn how to tune. Set your inductor, tune it, and it takes you 3 seconds. It's going to give you the widest range. That'll give you your 40 to 60 to 1. If you think the buying a radio, and this is why I'm going with this. You're thinking about buying a radio because it has an internal tuner. That may give you a 3-to-1. Learn how to work a manual tuner, a G-Match manual tuner, which is a cat-to-cat with a grounded inductor. And you can switch that inductor, and you can variably tune the cap towards your antenna device or your radio device side. If you learn how to do that within a few seconds, you're way ahead of the game. Just a bit of advice for people coming in who want to buy radios that have internal tuners and think that the radios are much more valuable because of that. Look at the value of the transmitter and the transceiver itself. KD2FIU.
WB2HRO, will you comment?
Yes, Joe.
Well, I might be able to solve the fellow's problem. I have, amongst other things, to sell 2 Johnson matchboxes. They're 50 years old, but they can handle a kilowatt plus. Over.
Okay, I'm sure that Tommy is still listening to us. He's logged out of EchoLink. He's talking in the chat room, but I'm sure he heard something. So, if you want to mention how you can be reached, Joe, if he's interested in acquiring one of your antenna tuners, please feel free.
Okay, I think it's Tommy. I have 2 Johnson kilowatt matchboxes. They're rated a kilowatt AM, so therefore they can handle like 1500 plus 2000 sidebands. My phone number is 718-896-1337. That's 718-896-1337. And I have a lot of other equipment, but I assume you want the capability of digital modes, and I don't have that. But the Johnson Matchbox would be the way to go, and Roy's correct. But back to net.
AC2GS.
Yes?
Roy, it's KD2FIU. If you wish, please ask him to bring it in tomorrow night at 8:45.
Are you talking about Tommy or are you talking about Joe?
Roy, it's your net, if you wish. If Joe wants to bring it in tomorrow night when everybody else is listening for it.
Yeah, certainly, George. I mentioned that at the top of the technical net, that Swap and Shop has been successful for many, many years. You do a great job, and you do it tomorrow after the InfoNet. So I would certainly encourage Joe to come back on to the Swap and Shop and talk about, mention your equipment that you would like to sell.
No problem. That's on this repeater tomorrow at 8:30, right?
George, what's a good time that the Swap and Shop will be running at?
2050. Roy, thank you. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry for bringing it that way. It's your net. If you want to let it in, go ahead. But I was just trying to bring it to a more viable forum.
No, I agree with you entirely, George. As I mentioned, I've spoken to Joe more than a few times, and when he came on tonight and he mentioned that he wanted to offer it, I said that we'll try and find a little time, but really to a more efficient thing would be to take it to your Swap and Shop where people are kind of programmed to inspect the goods and buy and sell, as opposed to here. People are used to, discussing technology and philosophy and all manner of things, and not much in the way of commerce.
Yeah, and my spiel on the T-Match network. Okay, thank you. The manual antenna match networks work for me. Thanks, Roy. KD2FIU, all clear.
Okie doke, and as I mentioned before, I'm sitting right next to an AT2KD, which is basically a T-Match manual. Love it, use it, and we'll continue to. So, I think there's a place for automated equipment and there's a place for manual equipment. I like them both. And I own them both. And I play with both of them. So be it. It's a good world. Anyway, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. We still have about 15, 20 minutes. If anyone has any technical or scientific questions or topics for discussion or wishes to tell me how something went that was discussed in an earlier TechNet, just give me your call sign and your first name.
WB2HRO with a question.
Yes, Joe.
You're talking about the different kinds of tuners, and I've had them all, not the, the Johnson ones are manual, and I have the STC-31, which is automatic, but it's only 100 watts. But my question is, what's your experience of what kind of antennas did you settle into? In other words, to have a resonating antenna, in theory, you don't need a tuner. And in your case, what antenna are you using, using it? I have other reasons why I'm letting go of the manual tuners, because there are too many things to try to monitor at the same time that I'm blind, and to use auditory devices to monitor the metering of the Johnson box at the same time, try to adjust it and stuff is a little too complicated. And especially if you're going to use an amplifier. I'm going to use them. That's the only reason I bought them, to use it around this little screen. But what's your feeling about what kind of antenna can you tune up to advise over?
Well, I mean, ultimately, anything that isn't resonant can theoretically be tuned up. There's a price to be paid. When George was mentioning correcting for a 40-to-1 Vizsla, that sounds nice. When you reflect upon the reflection losses of dealing with a 40-to-1 mismatch, and unless you're using open line where the attenuation losses are minimal, any kind of coax is going to use up a lot of those repeated reflected signals before they finally get corrected and sent out through your antenna. So there's a price to be paid. I use it principally for my fan dipole. My fan dipoles are very nice in that one structure has some degree of resonance across the board, but the bandwidth of them is not completely covering the entire amateur radio band, especially the 4080 leg of my fan dipole is a loaded, inductively loaded, shortened dipole. And so the Q is higher than it would be if it was a full length, and the bandwidth is significantly lessened. So I find that there might be a sweet spot on each band, but if I am interested too far away from that sweet spot, I need to get my antenna tuner tuned. Thankfully, for the most part, with the exception of 8040, I don't have to correct that terribly much, but I like to kind of get it as close to one-to-one as possible. Sometimes I realize that's almost a kind of obsessive compulsiveness. A mismatch of 1.1 or 1.2 does not really introduce that much of a loss to your transmitted signal. But still, so that's my philosophy. I have a stereo 5/8 wave vertical that I really don't have to tune up that much. It kind of works on the portion of 10 meters that I use. But it's the big thing that I use it a lot for is my fan dipole.
I get the story. I understand now. So your fan dipole, and it's cut short with coils. Yeah. That's why then. And of course, ideally the antenna tuner should, that's where the transmit matches goes to the antenna. But if it's a manual tuner, that's practical. You have to have open wire is good, except if depending on where you have to run it. I found out in the simulations I've done with open wire, it's okay if it's not near any metal objects, but if it is, then it's up. So, you know, it's all a compromise way. I've tried all these things and found out what I can use and what I can't. I have to get rid of the stuff I can't use. It just gets overwhelming.
KD2FIU summary.
Yes, George.
What I was leading to earlier is that a T-match manual antenna tuner of higher power capability that has limitations that are prescribed will perform much more better with lower power. For example, if you have a 2,000 watt manual T-match antenna tuner that performs within a certain amount of impedance mismatch, an SWR mismatch, will perform 10 times better with 10 times less power. So that you can take that antenna tuner and say that I'm going to buy an older, or I'm going to buy a 2,000 watt manual antenna tuner, although I will never use it for 2,000 watts. It could be an oldie, and you can buy it for a couple of $100. It could be a new model and buy it for $1,000. That doesn't matter. What I'm saying is that you can use that at 100 or 200 watts to match whatever you want. So the concept of the T-match actually is beneficial if you get a higher rated T-match antenna tuner and run less power to it. KD2FIU, my experience.
Okay, George. Personally, I don't think there's quite that linear relationship. That if you get something that's capable of 10 times the power, it now has 10 times the mismatch capability. I don't think that's quite how any impedance matching circuits kind of work, really. Power changes in the power level will have a slight adjusting of impedance matching for a given circuit, but I don't think it has quite the linear relationship you described.
WB2HRO.
It's not slight.
Again, I don't think I said it's not slight. I just said it's not linear. Joe, you wanted to say something?
Yes. Theoretically, there should be no difference in the matching capability of 10,000 watts of what it can handle. However, certain components may value and capability upon heating current going through them. Remember, there's no such thing as a perfect circuit because then you could do power limitation. Power limitation has to do with the losses. So I think George has probably experienced better performance from using less power. But in general, I would say you're right. It's not linear. And it depends on the tuner. It depends on all the other parameters. Because something has to give. Otherwise, you wouldn't need it if it's so simple. Back to you.
It depends on the inductor, the inductors in it, because I have Drake's and I have Kenwood's. They have multiple inductor to ground tuning circuits in them. They're very different with less power that you use.
Maybe they get saturated. Who knows? Their values may change.
No, they don't get saturated. They are less saturated with less power.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So you run more higher power, their inductive quality only stop at a certain point. They can't handle when I drop off what I'm watching, therefore you can't do that. No, and it has to do with each one. All right.
Okay, thanks, George. Thanks, Joe. I don't want anyone to get into an argument. This is a hobby. It's supposed to be fun. If you're not having fun, you're doing it wrong. I would suggest people look back at the impedance matching circuit website of Berkeley. Dick used to mention the Berkeley website for calculating impedance matching circuits almost every Sunday night. But it's a great site, and you can plug in the numbers, and you'll see that the standard numbers for all the matches, the pi match, the p match, the l match, are related to impedances capacitance and inductance, and not really to power levels. Again, I think that a lot of it, as Joe has suggested, are thermal effects. I think there is a difference, and very often people are advised once they tune up using low power to tweak their settings on high power. That was a very common suggestion for the final network of two transmitters that use the Pi network to impedance match the final tube circuitry with the 50 ohms output of a transmitter. So I think we had a great conversation about antenna tuners in general. I'm very happy that the conversation got picked up by Joe and by George, by Wesley, and by sundry other people. So that's very good. Anyone with any other comments about this or anything before we wrap this segment up? Okay, very well. Once again, I want to take this opportunity to remind people, if you can't get onto the radio or the chat room or what have you, and you would like to contact me and ask me what we used to call mailbag questions, because, you know, rather than on the radio, you put it in the mailbag. So any questions or topics of discussion, or if you would like to share some technical puzzle that would help me get across the concepts of physics or radio theory, or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to discuss something that recently was on YouTube or website or what have you. The email address is mailbag@ac2es.com. Again, mailbag@ac2es.com. Links are available if you want to do your calculation of your RF exposure for the FCC. That's going to require you to have that piece of paper someplace in your shack in 2 years. The website link is available. I put it up on my link page. There's a bunch of interesting articles that you can read at your leisure. That's available 24/7. All you have to do is type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the link page. I want to remind people that if you are out of range of Limark's repeater and would like to hear what's going on in Glen Oak, I try to keep a 24/7 stream going so that you could, if you have internet access, you just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you the audio stream. And as always, I'd like to remind everyone that Mike KC2NJI is maintaining a wonderful archive of the technical net that has gone back as far as September of 2006. Recently, he has clocked his millionth visitor to his website, and it continues to go strong, so please check out MikeAmateurRadio.tv. I want to thank everyone for their participation tonight, and call upon Paul, WS2N, to bring us this week's SpaceNet report.
Okay, very good, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N. And a good topic for this evening. And all technical. Very well done. Okay, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. We do this every week at around this time. And we'll bring you updates on all these things that NASA is doing and Roscosmos and Russia and China. That's what we do here. Anyway, first thing I wanted to talk about is NASA is actually recruiting people to sign up to be part of an experiment. They want to put four people in a building that's 1,700 square feet and have them live there for a year. And the idea is to duplicate what it would be like living on Mars. You know, it's roughly going to take around 6 to 8 months to get to Mars, and then they think they're going to live a year on a planet, and then another, you know, half a year or so to get back to Earth. So they want to see the, you know, the psychological aspects and technical. They're actually going to live in this building. They're going to have delayed communications. You know, let's say your planet Mars is, you know, 15 light minutes away from Earth. They'll have that delay, you know, transmit and receive. You know, what people will like better. You know, will text messages be better, which my guess is probably would be. You wouldn't have the audio delay. So, they're actually looking to employ people to do this. There's going to be 3 experiments. And each one will last a year. So the first one will start in a couple of years. I think they said, end of 2022. The fall of 2022 is the first one. And it's called the Mars Dune Alpha. That's what this thing is going to be called. Mars Dune Alpha system. It's a building that they've already experimented with this. They're going to actually make a 3D building using additive manufacturing for 3D. So they've got this massive machine. I think it weighs around 9,000 pounds. And it pushes out, you know, instead of your small paste, whatever you would use for a regular 3D machine, this is large. Got a big screwed connection to it, and it puts out a bead. I believe it's like 2 inches wide, one inch thick. And they've actually made this building, and it's gonna, the building when it's done, it's gonna have four different living quarters, you know, for the crew. The two bathrooms in this building. They'll have a recreation area and all of that. Dining, and they'll have food supplies. Supposedly, you know, they're going to try to grow all their own food. They'll have deliveries, simulating, I guess, maybe food coming on a Progress type cargo vehicle that would eventually land on Mars. Don't know how they're going to do this, but they'll have spacesuits. So they're on Earth. They've done this type of thing. Or colleges have done it with people locating what it would be like living on a moon. Well, this one is a Mars concept. So the Mars Dune Alpha project. You know, you have to be between 30 and 55 years old. You need some kind of education, usually in the STEM field, something to do with that. You know, science, technology. But, you know, if you're in pretty good health, because it's not going to be all that easy to stay in this building for a year, mentally and physically, to do something like this. And then they'll have a mechanical brake purpose, seeing how the four people will cope with this. So I thought I'd bring that up before we talk about real rockets and things like that. Interesting. Now this is by NASA, so you know you can actually go to the NASA site, look it up, and actually click on it, and, you know, sign yourself up. But I would be out. I'm a little too old for that. Any comments or questions? This is WS2N. Okay. Anyway, we'll continue on. I left a picture on Roy's website. Go to roy.ac2gs.com, and then there's other sites. If you go to the ICON, it's ICON is the name of the company that's going to be building these 3D buildings. And the idea is to actually make a 3D building on Mars in the future. with materials from Mars, and they have this machine that this 3D printer is massive. Like I said, about, I don't know, it's probably about 10,000 pounds long. But you know, you're programming it. You know what you want to do and make these buildings. They've done things for the military and things like that already, but now they're contracting with NASA to do this. So anyway, we'll move on to another topic, the Starship that I talk about quite a bit by SpaceX. All right. Starship system is coming along. They've been developing the top part of it, what would be the second stage, you know, called Starship itself, for quite a while down in Texas, Boca Chica, Texas. In fact, the area's gotten so big, they're calling the whole area Starbase. Elon Musk is giving it a name, Starbase. Anyway, in Boca Chica, Texas, they've put together the Starship, which is like 130 feet tall. Correction number, I think it's somewhere. No, 160 feet tall, like a 16-story building. And they've flown it, you know, a number of times. And most of the times it's crashed. But the final version of it, they actually did make it back to land. It's a reusable spacecraft. So this 160-foot towering Starship eventually put on top of a booster. The booster is going to be 230 feet tall. So just last few days, they've actually put one on top of the other using these 500-foot cranes to do it. They've built the tower to support it, and they wanted to put this on top, leave it there for a while as a fit check to see, you know, how things are going to go. They disassemble it again, separated into two halves. They're going to do further work. They're going to run some testing on both vehicles eventually. The idea is to launch this first one anyway. Would be the prototype, the first one that we'll actually test. Ultimate goal is to send these Starships to the Moon and to Mars. But for now, they would be happy to get it into orbit. Neither the booster nor the Starship itself has made it to orbit. And that's his goal. He wants to do it as fast as possible. And, you know, when you total the two heights together, first of all, they're about 30 feet in diameter, which is quite large. If you think about the Falcon 9 rocket, and that's only around 12 feet in diameter. This is 30 feet in diameter. The total height with the two together would be around almost 390 feet tall, which actually is a little taller than the Saturn V rocket that we sent astronauts to the moon with back in the 1960s and 70s. And with a lot more thrust. The Saturn V that sent Neil Armstrong to the moon and all the other landers that went there, including the other missions that didn't land, like Apollo 8 orbited the moon, Apollo 10 orbited the moon, Apollo 13. Just, you know, did a figure eight and came back. That was the one that had all those problems. But all those missions were launched by the Saturn V rocket, which had 7.5 million pounds of thrust. You know, the vehicle itself was around 6 million pounds, so you always need a little bit more than what the vehicle weighs. So that's what it was, 7.5 million pounds of thrust. This, once this thing lights off, and plans on doing it, you know, by the end of the year, and if you listen to Elon Musk, he wants to do it within a couple of months. But anyway, by the time he launches this thing, it's got so many engines attached to it, it will be around a little over 13 million pounds of thrust. So it's not quite twice the amount, you know, of a Saturn V, but, you know, it's getting close to it. He's got future iterations planned that will eventually become equal to, if not greater than twice the amount of thrust of a Saturn V rocket. But, you know, you got an idea of how big this is. You know, when you talk about these things on a phone or on ham radio, it's hard to imagine, you know, what this thing looks like. So I put a couple of pictures up on, again, Roy's website. He was good enough to put it up there for me at roy.ac2gs.com. And you can see what the vehicles look like, the booster and the Saturn V on its launch pad. I also included another picture of crews that are working on this. The workmen are working, connecting the two halves together. You know, they showed right before the two halves are connected together. And you can see the people, how small those people look. That gives you a good idea of the size of this massive rocket that they're building in SpaceX. You know, I recommend looking at that. You can find the pictures on the internet, but it's a lot easier just to go to roy.ac2gs.com to see what I'm looking at. Anyway, the engines that they're using, they're not Merlin engines that they use on the Falcon 9. These are bigger engines, over twice the amount of thrust of every Merlin engine. In this case, they're around 450,000 pounds of thrust for each engine. They're called Raptor engines, Raptor. They've been under development for, you know, probably 12 years or so. And he's gotten to the point where he's launched a few, he's launched some starships with as many as three Raptor engines. And they're the ones that went up to, you know, maybe 6 miles high and eventually came floating back down, relit their engines, and like I said earlier, most of them blew up on the launch pad trying to land, but the last one didn't. Actually, the one before the last one didn't either, but eventually it just tipped over and again blew up, but the final one did land successfully. And that's a second stage vehicle. His plan is to do the same thing with the booster. This is a 100% reusable rocket system, which has really never been done before. Even with the Falcon rockets, the second stage is a throwaway. You know, it deorbits and burns up in the atmosphere. But not this one. This one, both stages are planned to eventually come back and land. We fuel them up and be able to take off again. That's SpaceX goal. So the amount of engines that they put in this is just tremendous. This first stage booster is going to have 29 Raptor engines. 29. So if you do the math and multiply out the 29 times the roughly 450,000 pounds of thrust, you come into that 13 million pounds of thrust category. That's where they get that. So now that's just the booster that's going to put the second stage, you know, close to orbit. The booster gets to around 50, 60 miles high, and then eventually turns around and comes back and supposedly lands at the where it took off from. This case is Star Base is Boca Chica, Texas. Now the second stage will continue on. Again, it's the same stage it has flown to. 6 miles high with the three Raptor engines and came back and landed. That same design, not the same vehicle, but the same design, again, that part is called Starship, will have, instead of three engines, it will have a total of six engines. It'll have the same three that they had, plus three more. And the other three are for, basically because of when you get into a vacuum, you're allowed to have bigger thrust engines, and that's what the extra engines do. So that would have six engines to do what it's got to do. The first flight, if this thing ever gets off the ground, will take off. The booster that's designed will, you know, come back to land. Since it's never been done before, he's just going to let it come down and slowly hit the water in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, they're going to lose all 29 engines, of course, by doing that. It won't be recoverable you got any ideas to see if this thing can get off the launch pad and put the Starship itself into orbit. Now, once the Starship is in orbit, he's not going to do a complete orbit with the Starship vehicle. He's just going to go around the Earth and get as far as Hawaii. And then he's going to deorbit it there, and he's going to come down around 50 miles away from one of the islands of Hawaii, and slowly, have it come down slowly, coast through the atmosphere, and toward the end, relight the engines, and see if he could make it where he could simulate landing on land, but it's going to, of course, hit the water. Well, of course, all those three engines will be lost as well. But, if that's successful, then his next iteration will continue on, and eventually he'll start trying to land these things back where they launched from. And the goal, of course, is to eventually send these things to the moon and eventually on to Mars. He's already got contract with NASA to be on the final leg of landing people on the moon in 2024. NASA has this SLS Orion system where they're going to launch people to the moon, but you need to transfer over to another vehicle to, from Orion to land on the moon. And there was three choices. One by Dianetics, a company that was building a lander. Another one by Blue Origin, they're also building a lander. And of course SpaceX, and NASA gave the contract to SpaceX to do that. So they would take one of these Starships that are supposedly going to launch, this 160-foot thing, and it will go to the moon and then dock with the Orion spacecraft, and eventually have the crew go into, this four-person crew go into Starship, and the Starship is going to land on the moon. That is the present plan. Plans might change, but right now that's the present plan that actually NASA has. Let me stop for a while and see if anybody has a comment, and let me ID. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report.
WS2N, WB2HRO, question?
WB2HRO, go ahead.
My question is SpaceX configuration to the moon landing. Does that mean when the rocket leaves the second stage, leaves Earth, it will be raised and land on the moon, take off from the moon and come back? Or is there a transfer someplace orbiting the moon where you transfer to a module and it goes down to Earth?
Yeah, the initial plan right now, by the way, I think this might all change, but the initial plan is to have the Orion spacecraft launch on the SLS, Space Launch System that NASA is building. That's not a reusable rocket. That one's going to burn up in the atmosphere. But that SLS will launch the Orion spacecraft with a crew of four to lunar orbit. And, this is the first plan, which, by the way, I think will change. But right now, this is the plan. And then they're going to dock with Starship, this 160-foot thing, with six Raptor engines. It will dock with that. They will transfer the crew over. Orion will stay in orbit. And this massive Starship will, deorbit and land on the moon, come down a vertical landing, light its engines, slow itself down, and right before it lands, the present plan is, again, there's two plans for SpaceX, but the present plan is to have they're going to have these powerful thrusters near the top of the spacecraft, so maybe 100 feet up, but angled down on it, like a 30 degree angle sticking out of the side. Looks like about four of them. So they would ignite toward the end and then slow itself down and actually do the landing. The idea is that if you're using these big engines on the bottom, you're going to maybe create a hole in the moon. Debris will fly all over the place. You might damage some. You don't want rocks and stuff flying up into the bottom of the engine compartment. So these upper thrusters will slow it down. It will land on the moon. It's got looks like six big legs that will come out to support it. And then the door is up near the top. So they're going to have to open the door, and they have some kind of motorized mechanism that will, they'll actually be able to go down like a hot hoist. If you're in construction, you would know what that is. But it's like a small elevator with cable and pulley on it that would lower the crew and material down to the surface. And then, they do their moonwalks, whatever they're going to do there. And then eventually ride this cable system back up, go into the... back into a Starship, and I close everything up, and then take off using the larger engines.
Take off and come back to Earth, but I don't understand what they had to stop for they were orbit for with the Orion. What did that thing mean?
If you have the upper thrusters that are going to land you in the first place, maybe those things could relight and at least get you off the ground, off the lunar surface, far enough away from the moon where you can light the bigger engines. That might be a better way to go. Stop the debris and everything from flying all over the place. And then, anyway, that Starship would eventually go back into orbit, redock with the Orion spacecraft that's been flying around there with no crew. It's not like the Apollo days where you sent two people down and left one guy in the command module. All four would be going down to the surface.
No, but I don't understand what the Orion craft is, what the purpose of it is. If the SpaceX left the Earth, get up to, and is capable of landing on the moon, what is this Orion thing? What does it accomplish?
But I don't know what their plans are. I know their plans are not to bring it back to Earth. It will not have a heat shield, heat resisting tiles on the surface of this particular Starship. It's going to be used just for the moon. So we don't know what's going to happen with the Starship. But now the crew is in Orion, and the present plan is to have them use their engines on a service module and to push them back to Earth and then come through the typical way, with heat shields, parachutes, and land in the Pacific Ocean and get picked up by a ship. So that's the present plan. I this could all change, by the way. This is the part B if you want to hear it, what they're eventually going to do for many flights. Now, this is supposed to be the first flight, by the way. I disagree with I think they should go with the future plan B, which involves a space station.
Oh, okay. I understand what you're trying to do. So this big rocket then would be just left out of space junk up there?
I haven't heard a decision on what they're going to do with it. I know they're not going to crash it back into the moon. They would relight the engines and put it into a heliocentric orbit, around the sun, just get it away from the moon, Earth, and just around the sun. And, maybe a million years from now, burn up into the sun or something. But, I don't know the final plan. Back to you.
Okay. So it's half new, half old technology. So it's not a reusable rocket in that, in the true sense, as opposed to it. One shot
deal. Yeah, well, of course, that's for the first flight, and then as they get better at it, the idea is to actually leave maybe a future Starship, same thing, leave it in orbit, and actually refuel this thing and have it do multiple land. like I said, they haven't even gotten this thing out of orbit yet. NASA gave them a contract to do the landings. I don't really get it, but anyway, what I really think might happen, I might be wrong, but I think what they should do is do what they planned originally. Right now, this looks like a rush job just to get somebody to land in 2024. Originally, before they had this push to land somebody in 2024, the goal was 2028. I think they should go back to that. And I think it's further off, but it's a safer way to do it. If you've heard me on the net before, there's one project that they're talking about. It's actually partially funded. It's called the Gateway Space Station. Gateway Space Station will be put into a lunar orbit, but not the orbit that you would think about where you're, 100 miles off the surface. This is going to be like 40,000 miles off the surface at the furthest distance, highly elliptical, and maybe around 4,000 miles, the closest part of the moon. It's called a recto heliocentric, recto halo orbit is what it is. And recto halo linear. An area where it's balancing out the gravity between the Earth and the Moon. The idea is to, you really have to use, you really don't need hardly any fuel to stay in this orbit, like forever.
Yeah, I guess it's minimized in the amount of extra thrust you need. You still have to overcome gravity from Earth, and you don't get something for nothing, but I don't know quite I like this idea of this big rocket, 400 plus feet high, taking off, and then the first stage disposed of, that's only a one-way thing. Then the second stage lands on the moon, off from the moon, Orion, which is the analogy craft, comes back to Earth and splashes down. That's like a half-baked thing. Anyway, sounds interesting. Back to you.
And, SpaceX, not a Starship vehicle, but they're going to put it into our Falcon 9 Heavy. Falcon 9 Heavy is, is three Falcon 9s bolted together, and they've launched that three different times, so they know they could do that. They've had three launches of the Falcon Heavy in the past, and in fact, there's another one coming up this later part of this year. But anyway, they would launch the two first parts of the Gateway Space Station in that, send it to the orbit around the moon, and then eventually you'd be able to dock with that. And they plan on bigger modules or more modules in the future. But in the beginning, at least you would have two, and they're roughly the size of, a couple of the modules that they send up to the International Space Station now. So their experience with that, one is going to be built by Northrop Grumman, similar to the Cygnus cargo vehicle that they send up to the space station now, and that would be the Habitat module. So you'll be able to leave a crew in there on a regular basis. They're going to start out with 40-day missions. Send a crew, and they'll be able to stay up there for 40 days. And that would be their job. They won't be going down to the moon, but they'll be there to greet the incoming crew on an Orion spacecraft. And the Orion spacecraft would, again, dock with the Gateway. They'd meet up, have lunch, and get ready to that same crew that just flew out from the Earth to go down to the moon. There's two ways of doing that. SpaceX wants to take, again, their spaceship, Starship vehicle, and just go directly down to the moon. NASA had another plan, which I like better. I think they're going to go with this. They're going to have what's called a transfer vehicle. Now, this rectilinear orbit that they're in is, again, 40,000 kilometers out, maybe 4,000 kilometers closer to it. That's far. I mean, you're going out like this, the equivalent distance of, you know, our geosynchronous satellites on Earth, you know, like 20,000 miles out. And, but the you know, this, imagine the space station in that location. The Orion module docks with that. Then they transfer to a transfer vehicle. And attached to the transfer vehicle is the landing vehicle. So the crew gets in this thing, relatively large. Transfer vehicle goes down to lower orbit, maybe 60 miles above the lunar surface. And the crew leaves the transfer vehicle and they get into the lander. Lander goes down to the moon. They get out, do their EVAs, and eventually come back up. Come back up to that 60-mile height where the transfer vehicle is, redock with that, and then the transfer vehicle has enough power to bring you back up to the rectilinear orbit where the space station is, and then you dock with that, meet up with the existing crew that's you know permanently put on the space station, and then a couple of days you you know. Get your act together and get back in the Orion spacecraft and fly back to Earth. I like that system better. The transfer vehicle would be permanently there. You wouldn't destroy that. That would just be refueled over time.
It sounds interesting. It has to be perfect as far as its coordination because if something goes wrong, you're out of luck. You're stuck in an environment where you can't survive, over.
And for the transfer vehicle. So these things are all in the works, and it still might happen. Hopefully that would be the way to go. I think that would be safer. I think it would be better for the crew, and if anything happened, you would have the maybe the capability of another docked vehicle to go down to the moon to actually rescue these people that are, rolling the dice on just one vehicle. Might have two different landing vehicles attached to the space station at the time. They'll have multiple docking ports. They've already got plans for Antares to launch Cygnus resupply vehicles.
Sounds like a better way to go.
Gateway space station. Similar to what they do with the International Space Station. And we're also involved with other countries as well. Russia's out on this one, but Japan and European Space Agency is all part of this future gateway space station. And of course, amateur radio would be part of it as well. They're planning on, AMSAT anyway, is planning on not only RF communications, but maybe laser communications with Earth. They have, big dreams, too. When I say we, I'm part of the ARRL. Any comments or questions? WS2M.
WB2BX, cell phone.
Very good. WB2BX, cell. Go ahead.
Yeah, very good. Wondering if you'd watched any of the either posted two so far interviews with Elon Musk that Tim Dodd has posted. Go ahead.
Waiting for his unkey. Stand by.
What?
Something's not unkey. There, Frank. Standing by here. Good, I heard the courtesy tone. Okay, yes, I did see the first interview with Tim Dodd, and very, very well done. And it was long. I mean, I was surprised that Elon Musk gave him that much time. But I haven't seen the second one. Have you seen the second one?
Yeah, I just watched the second one last night. I'm not sure if I saw all of the first one, but it was very well done. The second one is even better. He really does a good walk around the shop there and what he's doing and changed some decisions on the fly. All significant things in the second one. He kind of mentions in passing that, oh yeah, once we're done with the testing here, we're going to do operational launches from the Cape, which did not surprise me because it's kind of nuts that the FAA and NASA would let them do very many launches, if any, from Boca Chica. It's just too darn close to too disruptive to a populated area. So that was probably the most significant thing, which was just kind of mentioned in passing, is that apparently once they do the initial testing, that they're going to have to move operations to the Cape. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. That's most likely. It's got to do something. The FAA is not happy with them so far with lighting one of these things off. You can get away with that down in Florida. You might remember, oh, by the way, what we're talking about is an interview on the internet with this guy, Tim Dodd. He's called the, was it the Everyday Astronaut? The name he goes on the, and Elon Musk is taking a liking to this guy, and apparently he's giving him, it's supposed to be three parts, and so apparently part two is out, so that's what we're talking about. And Elon Musk is, he's down in Texas talking to this guy, giving him a grand tour, and telling him his plans, future plans. But originally, he had two crews working on the Starships and eventually the boosters. And they were competing against one another. He had one crew in Boca Chica, where he is now. And then he had another crew doing the same thing in Florida. But as time went on, I guess the Boca Chica guys won, or you know, he didn't want to divide up his time. So, he sent everybody down to work on it, Texas. So now I guess the FAA is not, they went along with launching the Starship with three engines. He hasn't even done the six engines yet with Starship. What's going to do with 29, and eventually more. He wants to do 30-some-odd engines. He needs a different location. I guess Florida would be the best location. He has plans on launching these things and maybe even landing these inverted oil rigs, them to use these are massive things. These are 20-story buildings and float out here on the Gulf. And he's reconfiguring it, and he eventually wants to launch rockets and I guess maybe land them out there. But now he needs a permanent location. So I agree with you, Frank. I think something's going to have to be done where, I know he's got the okay. If you could launch a Saturn V from Florida, I'm sure you could launch the, he'll be allowed to launch the Starship booster and Starship itself from Florida. He's already got a location where he can do that. They had started setting up and getting ready for a launch complex. Right now he launches from Launch Complex 39A, and there's Launch Complex 39B, where the when NASA's on launching the Space Launch System from the Orion, and in between those two pads, he was going to he started a build, and I guess he's probably going to do that. What you say is true. Eventually launch from right near 39 A and B. I guess you can call it 39 C. Well, that's really, you probably have to call it 39 D. In the future, years ago, there was a plan for 39 C, even further away from the vehicle assembly building than B was. Maybe I'll have to call it 39 D. All right. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N. Yeah, let me cover this one story here, which I think is really kind of strange with the Russians. The Russians had a mishap with their new module they set up, Niagara module set up by the Russians a week or so ago. And they were a little problem here and there with the thrusters and, you know, communications with the antenna, docking communications called the CURS. And but they kind of worked things out. And then they slowly brought it in for docking to the International Space Station, the Russian side of it. And it's a big module. This is, you know, I mean, it's as big as their regular Zesda service module. Zesda, you know, has sleeping quarters for two people with the Russians and the gallery and meeting room and, you know, it's a bathroom. This is a duplicate of that, and it's attached to a space station. And everything seemed to go fine. The Russians were about to open the door, open the hatch to go inside and start setting things up. And they know they have like 11 EVAs in the future to completely, get this new Nyoka module in operation. But right before they opened the door, the thrusters inadvertently on this thing started going off. And these are powerful thrusters. They have different ones pointing in different directions. You know, you point it in the forward direction. And there's also thrusters pointing in the opposite direction. Ones that face the opposite direction start firing it, you know, and not shutting off. For an unknown reason, they just started going off. And that actually started moving the whole space station. And initially things started getting, you know, started to turn the whole big space station. And now Russia is the only ones that can shut it off. NASA can't. NASA has the, you know, Russia supposedly has they can do it from the ground.
That
then they start to get out of communications with Russia because the antennas start changing its location. So now they're losing 3-4 minutes at a time. And the initial report was they got around 45 degrees out of whack. And but now it turns out it's more than that. It went 1.5 times the whole space station turned, you know, flip-flopped over 1.5 times. To give you an idea, the space station is roughly a 30-story building, you know, over 330 feet in one direction. And almost 300 feet in the other direction with all these different spaceships attached. So it would be like being in a 30-story building and if you were in one of these modules and all of a sudden this whole thing starts turning. It'd be like the whole 30-story building rotating, you know, completely upside down. And then all the way around again, 1.5 rotations. They tried to stop it, slow it down, Russians did. First of all, they knew that something was wrong because there's these gyros on board. There's four spinning gyros. Normally keep the whole space station spinning in its proper attitude. And they're called moment gyros. These control moment gyros. They spin like thousands of RPM. Each one weighs like 600 pounds. There's four of them located roughly in the middle of the space station. And they started to feel the torque of the rocket engines being ignited from the Nyoka Russian module. And started sending signals and, you know, something's wrong here. We're starting to get it, you know, move out of proper attitude. So then once the Russians did, you know, establish contact and knew what was going on from the ground, they sent information to the crew, get out of that area. The whole crew, the seven people on board, went over to the U.S. portion of the segment. They closed a couple of doors and isolated the cells from the Russian side. But meanwhile, ground control in Russia is trying to stop these things from going off. They couldn't stop it, so they ignite the engines on this Zesda service module, there's plenty of fuel in that, to try to counteract the pull or the force of this module that's going off. That was not strong enough, so there's another spacecraft called the Progress that's attached to the space station. They reignite that as well to try to fight the force. Now it's like a tug of war is the wrong idea. It's like two spacecraft pushing against one another, I guess would be a better way of doing it. And finally what happened was they think the fuel ran out of the Niagara new module, and that stopped things. And eventually I think they used some thrusters and plus the gyros were able to start recorrecting the attitude of the space station. They wound up upside down, 1.5 flips. So they had to flip back another half, which they did. Puts a lot of torque and strain on all these joints. And, I hope no damage was done, but the last reports I heard, you know, everything's good. You know, no solar panels or heat radiators flew off the space station or anything. I think they dodged a bullet. And as a pressure gas for these tanks, you know, the fuel that was going off, so they vented the helium off, so this way there'll be no pressure where the, you know, behind the valves to accidentally ignite this thing again. You know, unexpectedly, you know, you can imagine doing a spacewalk or having another vehicle dock to the space station. It was supposed to dock the Starliner, you know, from Boeing. That was supposed to go up last week, but that was canceled. And sure enough, the other problems, Boeing has problems. The valves inside of the Boeing spacecraft are not in the proper location, so they brought the whole rocket back. And eventually that's got to be worked on before they can, you know, send that back, try again to send that back to the space station. But anyway, this is what went on with the Russians. They have a heck of a time. I think as time goes on, we're going to eventually get further away from the Russians unless their act really changes faster. Now, like I said before, they're no longer part of the group that's going to be financing or even sending modules to the new Gateway space station that's going to be going around the moon. I don't know. There's some 20 countries that are involved with the International Space Station, and Russia is like one of the main ones. I mean, for the last 10 years since shuttles have been retired, the only way we're getting up there has been with the Russian Soyuz rocket. Thankfully, that has changed. SpaceX has come up with the Dragon crew vehicle, and they've sent three different crews to the International Space Station so far, and then Boeing can straighten out this valve problem in the Starliner vehicle. Eventually, they'll have another crew-capable vehicle to go to the space station, also able to send up to four people on a regular basis. Anyway, I'm looking at the time, past the 11 o'clock margin. Anybody has any last minute questions? If not, I'm going to turn this back to Dr. Roy. Any other comments? Okay. I hope I don't put everybody to sleep. They'll wake up and see what happened to the net. We're back over to you, Roy. AC2GS, this is WS2N, and by the way, we'll be on tomorrow night. Anybody that's not a club member, it doesn't matter. You can check into the club InfoNet on Monday nights at 8:30 on these repeaters, and that would be followed by George, K2FIU, or you've heard on him before, who does the Swap and Shop, and then that's followed by Newsline. Back to you, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
AC2GS, thank you so much, Paul. WS2N, your SpaceNet report, all that you do for this net and for this club and for fellow hams. I want to thank once again everyone who participated tonight. We had a very active time, I think. I enjoyed it. I hope everyone out there who listens enjoyed it. The chat room was very active. Echo Link was very active. It was a very nice display of technology. And please, we're going to be back here next Sunday night at 8 p.m. Come back, join us, and see if we can do it all over again. As I often close the TechNet, I repeat the wise, wisdom-filled words of Dick K2RIW, who ran this net for many, 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 many years. He would very often end it with, be kind to each other. And as I've mentioned more than a few times, this is good advice in general, but great advice right now. We still live in dangerous times. The COVID virus is still out there. I don't think New York is going to get hit anywhere near places down south that haven't taken intelligent decisions. So please, once again...